Hi, everyone. Welcome to Flock Talk. I'm Aaron Morgan.
And I'm Jordan Sloggett.
And we work for the farmer members of the Ontario Sheep Farmers Organization.
This week, we are discussing agrivoltaics with Mike Carter. Mike is a founding director on the board of Agrivoltaics Canada.
Welcome, Mike. Thanks for joining us on Flock Talk.
Thank you very much for having me. It's nice to be here.
So tell us about yourself, Mike. How did you become involved in Agrivoltaics Canada?
Yeah, I have historically been a renewable energy developer, was a hydroelectric developer, come solar developer. And about 4 years ago, my business started doing work around greenhouse integration and PV development. And that sort of opened a window to this world of agrivoltaics and I guess the meaningful and economically viable path to integrating solar and agricultural in a more meaningful way. I found myself amongst a group of others across the country that had similar interests. We formed a working group that then about 2.5 years ago became an official organization, Agrivoltaics Canada. And I have been leading and spearheading the advocacy and policy works and just general engagement works for the organization within Ontario.
Mm. So, Mike, can you provide an overview of just what exactly agrivoltaics is and how it integrates renewable energy development with agricultural practices?
Yeah, so the term agrivoltaics, it's about a bit of a mouthful. It's a play on agro-photovoltaics, which is photovoltaics or solar. Agri-solar is another term that's used south of the border, or some of my colleagues like to use just dual-use solar. So the idea of optimizing land use around solar generation. And so that's the idea of being able to meaningfully continue to have agricultural practice while concurrently generating solar. The big difference in this agrivoltaic term, I guess the reason why this is important is that historically, solar, at least in Ontario, was seen as a binary option. It's either you can do agricultural activity on farmland or you can do solar and really not both or not really both in a meaningful way. And this is what we have been working to demonstrate and prove and working with groups that are either already employed and participating in it. So we're trying to grow that messaging or to identify and work to create more projects where we can actually further demonstrate and grow commodity groups such as sheep farmers.
Excellent. So building on that, can you tell us about the main benefits of agrivoltaics for farmers, the environment and energy production compared with a traditional solar installation?
Yeah, so traditionally or historically, solar was pretty impactful on the land. You would have compaction, soil removal, damage to the historic practice. But what we are pushing for and what's been demonstrated certainly around the world and Agrivoltaics Canada is an organization that has been historically housed at a Western University that have been studying and aggregating studies from around the world, demonstrating different commodities that are grown and yielding differing benefits. Shade tolerant crops grow quite well. And then all the way down the spectrum that depending on how you configure and orient the solar arrays, certain crops can grow better. Water benefits are certainly there. What we're seeing around, for example, with grazing is that the grass can grow better at times of the year where you wouldn't typically have the shading and the cooling effect that certainly benefit the later summer kind of grasses in drier climates. The microclimates underneath solar arrays are really seen as beneficial. We are seeing like windrowing up improvement for where you've got, you know, plains and the idea of being able to actually retain more snow load and in some of these areas around solar arrays. And then what has really been pushing is that as the cost of the solar continues to come down, there's an ability to be a little bit more sensitive to the soil compaction, historic crops. We've seen blueberry operations. We've seen certainly lots of sheep operations, but now cattle operations where you can do really all of those things that you could traditionally do on a farm Now, the only thing that we are continuing to work on is to try to figure out the economic benefit. We can raise solar panels up really high. We can spread them out really far. We can do a whole lot of things. We can make them less dense so there's more sunlight coming through. But it has to do with a cost balance, policy balance, what are the different drivers? And ultimately, for the farmer, you know, there is an opportunity for an economic benefit from having dual use. So what is, you can generate profit from either leasing the land to a developer, you can own and fund these projects yourselves from the energy generation and see that as a long-term reliable yield. And then what changes do you have to consider when, are you going to do smaller tractor farming? Are you going to change the kind of crop type that you're doing? Are you going to just do a crop based on, you know, say you utilizing 50% of the land or 60% or 70%? All of those things are all being studied at different levels around the world. Canada's a little bit behind in that, but I would say that we're historically a bit of a leader actually in the solar grazing. Quietly, there's been a lot of solar grazing going on and more sophisticated solar grazing than I think than many are. Many non-sheep people in the province weren't aware of to the extent that was actually occurring. So that's very happy to be here on this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Now, Mike, could you walk us through what the typical process looks like of developing an agrivoltaic project, from what goes into the initial planning and maybe sometimes what creates that initial spark of someone wanting to move forward with a project like this, and then all the way towards implementation of it?
Yeah, so the caveat to that answer is that there hasn't historically been a lot of commercially built agrivoltaics projects in Canada. Because this is really, I would say, seen as sort of cutting edge, because the cost decline in solar has come to a point where we can actually start having these conversations, where we're not in a subsidized product and we can actually compete with wholesale power pricing and sell into the market and benefit and not be tied to subsidies or programs that were a different version of solar in the past. Alberta kind of led the way around this, and we have seen some solar grazing activities on some of the larger farms. While I understand from some of these developers, it was a planned implementation, but it wasn't a condition of development. And what has changed now in Alberta most recently is they've actually restricted solar on farmland, but for the implementation of a meaningful agrivoltaic plan. Our approach at Agrivoltaics Canada, we've been lobbying and encouraging industry to get ahead of this and be there anyways. And so in Ontario, where we see the approach and how we're advocating for the approach and working with policymakers in the agriculture community and the energy community is to, I believe that the approach historically to renewable energy and specifically solar in Ontario was not having deep, meaningful stakeholder engagement. So really the first cut with the approach to agrivoltaics is engaging with the agricultural community, meeting with the farming community, understanding what the conditions, the requirements, what can grow there. So as an example, if we're talking to the sheep farming community, we're looking at opportunities where we can co-locate to either lands that already work within a policy mindset, so like lower class of soils, or lands that would be truly benefiting from sheep solar combined and have an economic case. Now, part of that site selection isn't just do we have farmers and municipalities supportive, but also do we have access to grid power to be able to sell that power out. So that's part of that site selection. So it's finding favorable communities, finding beneficial applications in the agricultural aspects. So it's certain crop types. Currently, as it stands, cash cropping is a bit of a difficult thing. Big tractor farming requires a different think around how you optimize and configure an agrivoltaic array. And that's in my putting on my professional hat as an energy developer outside of Agrivoltaics Canada, that's a harder economic case right now when I'm having to compete against multinationals that are coming in with low-cost power projects. Mm-hmm. So the best fit is finding a good connection between the existing commodity provider and the site and the conditions. Again, why we're here on a solar grazing conversation is that that's a great opportunity. And then on top of that, finding where is the transmission availability and can we make this thing pencil out? Are there environmental constraints? Then we go through that environmental, economic, social impact. Then we design the project, we engineer it, we go through all of the electrical designing and engineering. So there's a bunch of money that will have to be spent on, let's say, a 100-acre farm. We go, we find a suitable partner, we lock arms, and then we go through the process. And there's a whole bunch of different pathways to determine, do you want to take a lease? We can lease your land at a significantly greater rate than would be sort of a commercial cash crop lease. We would look at an arrangement around, can we get a commitment from either the landowner or an adjacent grazer that can actually service that so that we check the box on an agricultural assessment perspective, that we are kind of lobbying around policy for the creation of that kind of a requirements on the developer. And putting all of that together to hopefully have a project that we think pencils out in a competitive rate to then sell to the province who's going to be having. Right now, we assume we have to be toe-to-toe with everybody else. We would love there to be some kind of a scorecard that says, well, wait a second, this thing ticks the box of a lot of other social areas that we want to support as a province. But regardless, we have to be at a low-cost power price. And then we go through the construction and financing, installation, and then the O&M, which is the operation and maintenance long-term agreement. And so that would be what's interesting around the agrivoltaic angle, whether you're doing crop or sheep, whatever you've committed to, you can't just sort of do it for year one or year two and then go, oh, wait a second, we don't really like how that works. We just want to go back to mowers. We would be advocating that that the policy should have a requirement and an encumbrance on a developer that would ensure that you know, 25-year project ensures ongoing agricultural activity, not just for the land itself, but there is that concern about the checkerboarding of agricultural, prime agricultural lands that could be broken up if you don't have that critical mass or whatever you want to call it of agricultural activity in an area, which I fully appreciate. And how we're coming from this is to try to guard against that. And really our effort is to push for everybody to be doing this. So everybody's kind of on an equal playing field when competing to build the next renewable projects in the province.
Excellent. So we've been hearing a lot about the positives, you know, why you would want to have agrivoltaics in Ontario. It sounds amazing. It sounds like, you know, energy and agricultural production on the same land, economic benefit for everyone, renewable energy, all positives. So why is Canada, specifically Ontario, behind other places in the world in the development of this renewable energy?
So Ontario is a little bit unique in that we were seen as a leader in the early green revolution or push for really rapid renewable adoption. There was the feed-in tariff under the Green Energy Act was something that spurred a ton of investment into wind and solar in the province. When they created that program, it was exceedingly successful from one measurement perspective, and that was to get megawatts and dollars deployed and manufacturing set up in the province. But that program entirely relied on the program. Mm-hmm. The idea was to kickstart something greater. And what happened was there was very, very quick backlash to, in order to get that going, you had to get rid of, you know, what might be seen as red tape. But really what it came down to was, I personally believe the stakeholder engagement factor was the death knell to what ended up happening. So those that were being impacted by wind and solar projects that they didn't have a voice in opposing or being meaningfully engaged with became strongly anti for every possible justifiable reason that they could find. And I would say Ontario uniquely had a massive counter effect to that. And we still experience that to this day. So I was historically, admittedly, an anti-solar person at one time because I was a hydroelectric developer before I was a solar developer. And hydro required many years of early engagement, long-term engagement with broad impacted communities all the way up watersheds and making sure that you had everything covered. So that, I think, we have a hangover from that. It was so heavily subsidized, at least perceived to be, and continues to be, those contracts still exist to this day, that I think many people look at solar as a very costly product, a very damaging product, a very tax inefficient product. And right now we're at a point where I believe we can be delivering projects for under the grid costs for new power incrementally and continue to satisfy in short order without, you know, large project risk. But we have to inform people that this also isn't a binary thing. So the farming community were up in arms that the land was being taken out, rezoned industrial, and in some cases, farmers weren't allowed to continue farming on some of the lands that weren't even impacted on these projects. So that's the history. That's not the current world. But there's only a handful of us right now with that messaging, and we're just doing everything we can to get the word out that there is a better way. And we're looking to talk with anybody that's willing to listen to us about, you know, about that and slowly change minds. But we have to demonstrate that as well. We can't just tell people. We need to show more examples. People need to see these farms that have sheep on them already.
So speaking of changing minds, I want to know, what changed your mind? You were a hydroelectric guy. Now you're a solar guy. What was your journey? How did you change your mind?
Ooh. Yes. So one of mine, there were many, many reasons, and I'm admittedly this hypocritical environmentalist and hypocritical solar person and hypocritical many things, but what I could see that the world in which I lived in and when I was building hydroelectric projects that similar to what my father did before me, was we were building 100-year-old assets that were built on 100-year-old technology that were reliable and supportive and low cost as it compared to the other technologies that just so happened to be emitting. But that wasn't why my family got into it. It wasn't a climate change. It was a building a better product that just so happened to be good for the environment and good for the good social impact. And every year, hydroelectric pricing would go up. And that was okay because that was how the model worked. And everybody else's cost of steel and technology and concrete and labor would go up. So we would be in line with nuke and in line with gas and in line with, so that was no problem. And then the solar thing that was way, way, way out of market was just not even a consideration. And I intended to retire as a hydroelectric developer. I love it. I still do. But I could see that my future was closing. And about 8 years ago, I could see that we were maybe 1 or 2 years out from a local cost convergence in Ontario that would say we can actually build solar for cheaper than what hydro can build and what the grid needs to see. And so there were business factors that led into that. I still did not get around the land thing. I had some real issue with that. Some of my first efforts were with the University of Guelph when I first joined a company that was a large developer, was to engage and say, are there ways that we could treat these solar farms and be more careful with the soil and then have them in a way that we could take these solar arrays back out and kind of treat them as land banks for, you know, 20 or 30 years and just kind of leave the land as it was and rest it. And that was kind of we were getting there because the technology around installing, so the actual constructability, was getting more better and better. We were moving away from grading all of these projects and turning them into large industrial, you know, grass top parking lots that would just have stormwater management as the big concern. Touching them as little as possible, putting the piling in, that was coming. And the idea of being able to pull these piles back out. And I thought that was really interesting. But again, we were talking about something that still wasn't even wasn't even economic at the time. And then the Ontario market closed. So that's where I was shifted to Alberta. And this is where I really opened my eyes, is we ended up winning 100% of the Alberta provincial procurement, which was a big deal for us. We were doing some demonstration projects that were actually subsidized. And then within a year and a half, we bid into the Alberta procurement unsubsidized, and we were able to sell power into gas country in Alberta, which is a higher latitude than here, for 4.7 cents per power. And if anybody knew that you could buy power for 4.7 cents in Ontario, you would take it all day long. That's what really got me excited. The agrivoltaic thing was like, it'd be really nice to be able to do that, but we just can't do it. Well, the cost price just continues to decline. And now we're arguing against my old self and arguing and telling my old friends that you need to de-optimize your thing. You need to do a little bit better. We can preserve this land, because the sustainability of solar and the future of solar requires that we have those that have the land and those that are exposed to the land. The stakeholders need to be on board with this. And as soon as I saw that that was a possibility, I've just been all in on this. And that the idea that we can actually have those traditionally opposed to be the beneficiaries of solar, that's what excites me. And that's what, you know, that's where I see this, again, this new, another paradigm shift. And we're just really excited about the sheep aspect, but there are other crops that are looking really good, but it does, operationally, it requires a little bit more thinking around how to optimize some other crops. Or we have policy that, if we had policy that supported other crops, then it would be a no-brainer as well. And we could do a whole lot of other things, but sheep doesn't require a big shift. It would be nice around a land use opening up to allow for, you know, certain lands to maybe accommodate more, because that would just, that would allow for a lot more opportunity to optimize the grid potential.
Cool. Thank you.
So thanks for sharing some of that, that history there, Mike, and kind of jumping off from that, what trends or developments are you seeing today that are, you think are going to kind of shape the future of agrivoltaics and renewable energy developments in Ontario?
I think the most exciting thing I've experienced is engaging with farmers at a grassroots level and realizing that the historic or perceived opposition isn't as entrenched or as hard as maybe a lot in my industry believe there to be this genuine opposition at, whether it's the Ontario Federation of Agriculture or others that would be just fundamentally opposed. And that's just not really, that's not been the experience that we've had as we've actually engaged and been able to explain what we're trying to achieve. And I have to make it clear that Agrivoltaics Canada has been really cognizant and conscious of trying to ensure that it's farm first solar. So while I'm a developer here in my day job, we are advocating for farm first solar. So this is very much at the core of that advocacy group. And when we have that conversation with people, the conversation might be, the opposition might be, hey, well, you know, we like solar, we have it on our barn, why not put it on the rooftop? And I'm all for that as well. It's just that that's a different product in my business. The rooftop could cost upwards of three times the amount, and it's great, and it's a perfectly suitable solution for on-site needs and offset. But if we're trying to provide something for the broader public, we need to be able to do stuff at scale.
So I want to go off your farm first. I want to understand what that means. So can you give us an idea of how farmers will work with solar companies on projects in the future, both as a landowner and as a grazing partner? What does farm first mean to Agrivoltaics Canada?
Yeah, so I can speak for it. So at a board level, the intention is to ensure that we're advocating for policy that is truly ensuring that there's an agricultural focus to the policy that we're trying to achieve. So farm first means that we're seeking to have genuine, demonstrable agricultural continuity with the farm. And it's difficult to at times describe how that can be, because some of the conversation may come back to, well, what's the revenue number and what's the cost number? And when you're putting solar on a farm, you're going to have a per acre revenue is a significant amount of energy that's going to be generated from that. You know, if you're doing an acre of ethanol, you're getting the equivalent acre of solar can generate about 150 times the kilometers if you're running it through an EV car versus. So that's a very, these are big numbers of tens of thousands of dollars of revenue that are going to be coming off per acre, but you're also putting in tens of thousands of dollars of infrastructure to pay off, or hundreds of thousands of dollars of infrastructure. But you need to also make sure that the farming characteristic and the underlying activity that was happening there that may represent a fraction of the revenue is still meaningful on a continuity perspective. And that's sort of preserving the culture, preserving the industry that we are committing to preserve. And so the idea that getting away from greenwashing or green leaning, I heard yesterday, is like, we need to be very careful and cognizant of that. And that's when I say it's farm first, is are we approaching our policy positions that we are comfortable that we are not simply representing big renewable? And that's the difference between ourselves versus, say, an industry association like CanREA, which is by definition a renewable energy advocacy organization. We are not that.
Okay, so a farmer partners with a solar company. What does that look like from the farmer's perspective? Yeah.
So putting on my developer hat, my approach, and I believe that the approach of agrivoltaics is really just getting the kitchen table conversation is the starting point, explaining in full detail, this is what you're doing. You're looking at developing a 20, 30 year partnership with that developer. It's a bit different than saying, we are just going to lease your land and this is the number and here's what you can do until we build the solar farm. So sometimes there'll be an option and a lease agreement. And if the project doesn't go ahead, you can still cash crop this until or do this. But as soon as this project goes ahead, inside that fence is our thing. That's not what agrivoltaics is doing. Agrivoltaics is approaching this in an intentionally complex manner to ensure that, is the fencing right for, let's say, in a sheep situation? Are we managing the cabling correctly if we're doing some kind of a cropping activity? So when the tractors are going, are we configuring the facility to meet the equipment and the crop type? But in the sheep case, are we looking at paddock planning? Are we looking at water management planning? Are we looking at how you're going to be moving those flocks around? Again, the fencing, it's not keeping people out, it's keeping predators out. Are we ensuring that we are creating a scenario where you can actually have a viable grazing service that you don't have to babysit 24/7 or whatever? Those are the conversations how that conversation starts. When I say a true partnership, that's really how I feel that I've brought my hydroelectric development background to the solar world, where it's a bit of a different, like, we want to understand what you need. I don't need to know how to be a solar grazer or a sheep farmer. That's a complex, every conversation I have, it just adds multiples to what I realize I don't know about the space. I do know enough to be a little bit dangerous in a conversation, but I'm not going to be supposing that that's something that a large multinational operations company can go, hey, we're agrivoltaics, we have sheep. You know, sheep can be sensitive animals that do require some there. And that's by exciting that it's actually in full long-term employment is a unique skill set as well. That I think really brings a new shepherd opportunity specifically back to the province, where people can be meaningfully employed in that.
So then so from the economic side, if you're a landowner, there's an opportunity for a lease arrangement. And then if you're a producer, with or without land, there's still an opportunity to have an income, right, from grazing the land that the solar occupies. And there's like some landscaping payments for that? How does that work?
Yeah, sorry. And so, yeah, no, exactly. Shooting from the hip, let's say a well-suited solar array that can be configured for a solar grazing operation, you might consider $1,000 an acre as a lease right now. There, this number can move around. It all depends on the suitability. But let's say it's $1,000 an acre, sort of ballpark, a reasonable number to talk to. On top of that, you're looking at a grazing service. If you're on site and you're already doing a sheep operation, it probably is a low bar to be able to achieve to service that. But let's say that's probably in the, I think right now we're ballparking $200. We've heard up to $500 per acre for grazing services. But let's say it's a $200 per acre in the coming years for servicing that on top of that. So you've got $1,000 if you're the landowner per acre. You've got $200 per acre for the operating. You get the benefit of the sheep growing under shade and growing and eating and consuming all of that grass. And you have an obligation to meet a vegetative contract. So that's a bit of a different pivot around how this grazing services would work. But we would, as an asset owner, you would have an obligation to meet criteria around weed management, grass management, to make sure that it is within a certain tolerance. That changes how you're going to optimize your flock. You do have to keep your flock around either longer, keep more mouths to feed at different times of the year, and feed them off site at different times of the year. But that's the benefits that you're seeing is, yeah, it's $1,200 per acre, and then depending on what. If the landowner happened to also be an investor or a partner in the project, then there would be a portion of the revenue from the solar array. That's, you know, all of those options are on the table. I think that right now where we're seeing, there's probably a much better chance that there's going to be more solar acres, photovoltaics constructed, and there really are acres of sheep farms actively grazing right now. So there'll be a need for those with the service capability and the mouths to service those areas to be able to actually grow and address additional acreage that would have that would need to have grazing services. So we do see like a great potential for upward pressure on the need for additional grazing services and additional sheep in the province, like what we've seen happening in Texas and even Alberta too. So.
And these contracts, like, they improve year over year, right? There's like an interest built in. And then at the end, you take your equipment, like there, you leave the land like you found it or better. Is that kind of the.
Well, I would love to say we take it all away in 30 years and it's all better. But realistically, like the hydro world, is that we would build projects hydroelectrically to economically be a 40-year asset. But realistically, if those projects still have viability or still have value, there would be an incentive for the developer to go back to the landowner and re-request to update and upgrade and re-contract for that period. That all being said, at least pointing to the most recent history in Alberta, because Ontario doesn't have large-scale recent history, but there would be baselining on the soil conditions and then obligation to meet those soil conditions as a condition of environmental permitting, to meet those soil conditions at the end of life of the contract. So theoretically, if the project were deemed to be, you know, done with and we're not looking to pursue it and the farm does not want to re-engage at 30 years, you pull up those piles and you remediate to meet the preconditions as required. Our hope is to be able to demonstrate, at least in certain cases, where there's been soil improvement on that land. So that would be a really exciting find. There's been studies around that kind of grazing improvements. You know, I certainly am familiar with some regenerative studies that I would love to see that synthesized for solar grazing, but that's the hope. Thanks, and sorry, you also asked about incremental pay. So typically most contracts are tied to some form of a CPI. So as an example, there are contracts that may be tied to a 2% consumer price index escalator every year, so that you know, $1,000 today might sound really great, but in 30 years time, it might feel like $30. So you just make sure that you're keeping up with some assessed. And that is part of the negotiation and, you know, all things considered, but that is typical to have an escalator in these agreements, just the same as the power sales would have a escalator in the agreement. And just the same as, you know, you might have a solar grazing contract that might be a 2-year or a 3-year contract that in all likelihood, those prices and those costs rise too.
Okay.
Well, a lot of great info there for our listeners. And Mike, if producers interested in learning more about the opportunities for solar on their farm or working with a solar company to graze land near them, where can they go to learn more?
Yeah, so AgriVoltaics Canada has a website, agrivoltaicscanada.ca. We have a contact us page. We have a discounted rate for farmers that would like to be members of AgriVoltaics Canada. There's a $50 fee for farmers. That's very specifically the sort of one of the lowest tranches we have, because we want this to be a farm-led organization. We have a number of farmers that are members already. And so we would be very happy to respond to that. As the Ontario representative, I would likely be the point person, at least for those that may be listening here in Ontario. And yeah, we would be very, very pleased to reach out and discuss the advocacy and potential paths to develop projects as well.
Perfect.
Thanks, Mike, for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on our podcast.
Well, thank you very much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Join us next Wednesday for a research-themed interview.